to actually have liberation, we need to be giving power to the most marginalized people. It doesn't help a child whose parent is being deported. The person doing that is Priti Patel or Suella Braverman.
Hello and welcome to Pop and Politics,
the podcast where we delve into the world of music for politicians.
I'm the pop fanatic Alex Charles.
And I'm the politics specialist Isaac Marley. Do love a bit of Dua Lipa though.
I mean, me too. We're going to be talking about how music influences different people, how we can sort of understand music through politics, and finding out what our MPs are listening to right now. So with that being said, turn up your volume, get ready to immerse yourself into the world of pop and politics.
And today on the podcast, we've got the Labour MP for Nottingham East, and it's Nadia Whittam. She joins us today on the podcast. Hi, Nadia. Welcome along.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
No worries. Thanks very much for being on today. Thank you.
So, should we just take it away? So, what was it like being such a young MP, and how old were you when you got into politics?
Yeah, so I'm currently the youngest MP in the House of Commons in the UK. I'm 26 now, and I was 23 when I was elected.
That is crazy. That's insane. Like, to think, so I'm 22, to think you were 23 when you were elected that's incredible. That must be like a huge life achievement for you.
Honestly, it was such a whirlwind. Like, the selection happened. So that's where Labour members in your local party choose who the candidate is. And I won that election. And then I think it was just the next day that a snap election was called. So that whole thing was a whirlwind. And then very soon afterwards, we went into lockdown. So yeah, I feel like there hasn't really been time to process it. It's just become part of my life now.
When you were sort of growing up, sort of pre-politics, what was the sort of music that you listened to growing up?
So I think when I was a young kid in the house, my brother's 10 years older than me, and my mum didn't really play music. I mean, she played like a little bit of Aretha Franklin, which is great, and I love Aretha Franklin. But it was mainly my brother who was playing music, and it would always be drum and bass, which obviously isn't really our generation's kind of music. It's more like millennial.
I would argue drum and bass could be our generation.
Yeah, I think sort of like it's the music that we heard older, like teenagers listening to when we were kids.
Yeah, no, I would say, so as a sort of fresh sort of uni grad, I listened to sort of a lot of sort of not techno, drum and bass, and then heavy sort of pop music in uni. So I think the argument is there that yes, maybe we could, like our generation do listen to sort of drum and bass. But Aretha Franklin, you mentioned, she is a very, very respectable artist. Would you say she's someone that you listened to a lot sort of growing up?
It was more kind of my brother's music that was playing. So yeah, a lot of like really heavy drum and bass, jungle, bit of R&B and hip hop as well. And then kind of when I was at school, for the worst kind of era of 2010s music, like the kind of 2009 to 2012 JLS Ed Sheeran.
I can't believe you've just said that. Oh my gosh, that is like my favorite era of music ever. Like, you could not have like just shattered my heart if you wanted to try any harder. That is like JLS.
Oh, you really started on a bad footing.
I literally retweeted a post about JLS's new tour that they're doing in November. Literally, like, this morning, I'm a massive JLS fan, massive Dua Lipa fan.
Oh, yeah, Dua Lipa's amazing. JLS, I mean, like, for the nostalgic value, being quote-unquote mainstream was, like, the worst insult ever. But I think that's kind of changed now. I think pop music is a lot more popular. And I think that's partly because it's better. And also, I think people kind of want to be part of a common experience a lot more. I don't want to say it was bad music, but it's not it's not music that I'd listen to and enjoy now, but stuff that I loved in like year eight. Me and my friend, like my best friend at school, Amanda, we used to have like one headphone each, and we'd be listening to like N Dobbs' entire works.
No.
Nice. I don't slip or trip when she asks me where I've been.
Don't get me wrong, Beat Again, it's a banger. But I don't think you can say that JLS were the height of 2010s or noughties pop music.
All of this JLS slander, what have I done in life to deserve this? Like, seriously.
I mean, I can just imagine it now. The late 2000s, early 2010s, you know, JLS are the big thing. One Direction are still yet to be the big thing. It's the days of BBM, BlackBerry Messenger, and, you know, you're going on your way home after school. I can see those days. And, you know, it's very interesting in a way because a lot of the music around about that time, I listened to bits of it here and there, but a lot of it was very of its time. Like, you'll never believe this, Nadia, but I was going on a walk a couple of days ago, and for some reason I decided to listen to Price Tag by Jessie J, and I thought to myself, ah, yes, I love this. This is going to be great. Such a throwback. It's going to be amazing. And then I listened to it for about a minute or two in, and the one thing that I just thought of was, I've got so many memories of primary school, but that song feels very much of its time. It was very early 2010, so I completely get you about your comment about, you know, be obviously the pop music then was very mainstream, and, you know, it was great that you were listening to N-Dubs at the time. So during your university years, what would you say were like the main kind of musical trends during that time as you were studying in university? What was big on the scene back then?
Grime was massive then. Jeremy was really big.
Man don't care about all that.
Skepta, Stormzy.
Manchester's better than me. Tell my man shut up.
And then like people like Dave.
I changed my number a couple times. The man kept calling me for things a man are hating, but they're waving when they saw me on their strip. I know.
Kano. That was incredible music, and I think it was kind of the first, maybe this is a bold claim, but the first kind of political music of our generation, because like when you look at our parents' generation, they had loads of political music, like The Clash, The Jam, The Who. But for us, I think everything was quite apolitical, or it had bad politics, like Eminem rapping about killing his wife and how difficult it was being discriminated against because he was white.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very interesting that you mentioned that, because I was also, as well as liking you know, dance music and pop music, I do still enjoy other genres as well, grime being one of them. And I do remember Skepta being really big on the scene back in 2016, that era when he released Konnichiwa, and that album was just a standout moment. Obviously Kano appearing on Jules Holland, I'm sure you've seen the clip, Nadia, where it's him and he's performing on Jules Holland, and he's standing there and he's performing SYM with the crowd in the background, and not the crowd, the choir in the background, and it's just a moment, and he's smirking, he's just smiling there because he's getting away with those lyrics on national television. Like, honestly,
an iconic moment.
Absolutely. Mid-2010s music, especially that particular genre, was definitely a defining moment. And obviously there have been several histories in the stage of rap music over the couple of decades. And but that was definitely a real defining moment as well. And again, like, even at the Brits as well, when grime artists started winning awards, when Skepta started coming out on stage, So JME started coming out and they started winning awards. And obviously, as we go into the later part of the decade, Stormzy and Dave, as they won awards, and when they started doing Brits performances as well, that was definitely a real defining moment as well. So it's really interesting that you brought up Dave, least of all because we are also, me, Alex and I, of course, are obviously two young boys from South London. So we grew up with that scene. When we hear Dave, we understand what he's going through.
Can I just say, my subtle flex, I've seen him live 5 times, you know, just a little flex.
Oh my God, incredible.
I am a massive, massive Dave fan, and I'm also a massive Stormzy fan. I was lucky enough actually to see him perform live at the Brit Awards for his what's now seen as iconic call out to the members of government, especially Theresa May in 2018. And Dave obviously has done a Brits performance in 2020 where he directly addressed members of the government in his performance. Would you yourself want more artists to openly talk about politics and sort of these really impactful situations that are going on in our society today in their music? Would you think that's a sort of benefit as such? Because I know in genres such as grime, they're not afraid to say how they're feeling honestly, but almost in mainstream pop, it seems like there's no really one person that sticks out to constantly be talking about politics or directly addressing the situations that are going on in society today. So I just want to know, do you think that would be a good thing if more artists in different genres started doing that?
I think that's right. And especially like when we look back at the past couple of decades at like what has made it into the charts, and it has been very kind of apolitical stuff. So that's why it was such a huge thing for like Dave to talk about Boris Johnson as being racist, which is something that was evident in so many of the things that Boris Johnson said. I spoke about it in my maiden speech, which is the first speech that you give in Parliament, about Boris Johnson talking about Muslim women as letterboxes, talking about gay men as tank top bum boys, and other horrific bigoted stuff.
But December 2019 comes along, and then we now have news of an actual general election. And the election happens. Brexit is in the backdrop of this general election. A lot of people at the time were saying, it's a Brexit general election. And you then get elected as Baby of the House in the general election in December 2019. And I think as we move forward within that particular year, as both Alex and I come to the end of our teenage years at that time, I just wanted to ask, what was it like being Baby of the House? What was it like being elected at such a young age?
It was honestly such a whirlwind. I look back at it and I just feel a bit stunned, to be honest. And it's quite hard to know what to say about it. I think I was never expected really to be elected to be the candidate for Nottingham East. And then I was, so that was kind of the first surprise. And then we weren't expecting an immediate general election, and that happened. For me personally, I was really unwell. I had horrible flu, and my doctor said to me, you can't go to the election count. Which obviously I couldn't not go to the election count. So I was so unwell, I could hardly like dress myself and stuff. So my friends came round and they like helped me to get dressed. I was lying down in front of the TV with a sick bowl, and we were just watching the results coming in, and Labour seat after Labour seat turning blue. And I remember seeing Gedling, which is the seat that is next to me in Nottingham East, hearing that Vernon Coker had lost his seat, and he's always been the Labour MP for Gedling since I was only a few months old. And that was a real shock. So all of it was just a blur. Like, I was the first MP of colour in Nottingham or Nottinghamshire. I was not just there to represent the people of Nottingham, but also to represent our generation. A few weeks later, COVID hit, we were into lockdown. I went back to my former workplace. I used to be a care worker, and I went back there to work part-time during the pandemic. It all happened so fast, and it was such a culture shock.
Yeah, I know. I completely remember the time period as well, because again, as you mentioned, everything happened so fast. And it literally went, it definitely felt like we went from the election to COVID in the blink of an eye. And obviously it's very good and it's very inspiring to hear about your achievements to actually get where you were, but also the fact that you went back to your old career, because obviously many of the politicians that were around during the end of the election period going into the pandemic remain politicians, but it's very interesting to hear that you actually went back to your old job. You essentially went back to the front line of the essential key workers that were working during the pandemic. So things like the youth climate crisis, things like standing up for better representation and equality and diversity, those campaign points, am I right in thinking that they still form, they have been and still form the basis of what you campaign for as an MP for Nottingham East?
Yeah, I mean, for me, like, I very much kind of came out of the Labour movement, and I, that's what I represent in Parliament. So, like, striking workers, people fighting for better pay and conditions, people fighting for racial justice, climate justice, housing justice, to actually have liberation, we need to be giving power to the most marginalised people in our communities. So, for example, having people of colour at the top of government, it doesn't help a child whose parent is being deported that the person doing that is Priti Patel or Suella Braverman. It doesn't help people who are having to go to food banks that the Chancellor, the Prime Minister has been Rishi Sunak and Kwasi Kwarteng.
It's very interesting that you mentioned that, because I was literally about to say as well, Kwasi Kwarteng became Chancellor. Would you say that more David Lammy and Diane Abbott are more the people you want to see representing people of marginalised communities in government? Are those the kind of people that you want to see going forward?
I mean, I guess I can't answer that in a non-partisan way, because I'm a Labour MP, though, of course. And Diane Abbott is a huge trailblazer as the first Black woman MP, as are other MPs like Angela Eagle, who was the first MP to come out as a lesbian and the first lesbian minister. But I think more what I'm getting at is that we need the lowest paid people, like cleaners, care workers, the most marginalised people, like sex workers, trans people, to have power in our society at all levels. And just being represented in Parliament or having that diversity in Parliament isn't enough.
You are going to face quite a fair bit of backlash, quite a fair bit of criticism, given the fact that you are, not to be stereotypical, but obviously you are outside of a major city, and obviously you are in an area whereby there will be people who are older, who vote Conservative, and there are going to be those people that do come out and they would criticise the things that you do or the things that you stand for. And as such, I'm pretty sure that it was not inevitable as such, but with the amount of criticism that was coming your way and the fact that there would be people who would be very strongly against what you did stand for, over time, understandably, this would have caused an impact on your mental health. And this became a public story at the time when in 2021, you took some time away from your MP role to focus on your mental health. That period in 2021, where you decided to take time away from your career to focus on your mental health, what was that period like? What was the situation at the time? What was leading up to it then? And just what was the general mood at that time as you took time away from your political career?
Yeah, so I was very clear at the time that I took a leave of absence because I have post-traumatic stress disorder. I was very clear at the time that that was completely unconnected to my job, and that certainly didn't happen as a result of any sort of criticism that I've received, which is very much par for the course. But you know, you get post-traumatic stress disorder from experiencing a sort of very traumatic, often life-threatening situation, but I haven't disclosed the source of my PTSD. But the decision that I made at the time was, it became clear to me that my PTSD was getting worse rather than better. And I needed to take time out to get support and to recover. I mean, obviously that's a journey. It's not a quick thing, and it's something that I'm still dealing with now. But the reason why I wanted to be open about why I was taking that time off is I thought, you know, I may as well be honest about this.
I think the first thing that I've just got to say is thanks very much for being open and honest about your situation, of course, because I think it was very important to clarify that your PTSD situation was not directly linked to the job that you were doing, because I remember seeing several reports at the time saying, oh, she took time off because the job was getting too stressful, this, that, and the other way.
If not my favourite artist of all time, then Miss Education of Lauryn Hill is definitely my favourite album of all time. It was groundbreaking, and a lot of the artists we have today just wouldn't have existed, or wouldn't have existed in the same way, if it weren't for Lauryn Hill and that album. I've been listening to a lot of music by queer artists recently, like Janelle Monáe, Rina Sawayama, Ollie Alexander and Years and Years. Rina Sawayama, one of her tracks, Chosen Family, like really resonates with a lot of queer people. We don't need to be related to relate. We don't need to share dreams or a surname. Even if you do have the support of your family, you also find another family in the LGBTQ community.
The queer community within music, I think it's extremely important. And I've sort of found myself exploring the queer community within music much more recently. Hand me a pen and
I'll rewrite the pain. It feels particularly powerful, doesn't it, when you see people who look like you in some way kind of leading it within the music industry. Honestly, I have such a list of stuff from my friends that they want me to sneak into Parliament. Like, my friends couldn't care less that I'm an MP.
I have a feeling that some of the ones on your list are probably like really embarrassing ones, like, oh, say this naughty word, or say this rude thing, or say this particular innuendo. And it's like, I can't fit this in because it's going to get picked up by everyone and no one's going to take me seriously. I feel like that's the vibe your friends are going for, something really edgy to really throw you off your speeches or something like that. That's what I'm thinking. There's just one final serious question that I want to ask you, Nadia, and this might be a little bit left field, but I just want to kind of get your general view on it. So obviously over the course of the last hour and a half, we've talked a lot about pop and politics, and we've talked about the music that you've grown up with and kind of your political sphere and your kind of left-wing bias. And you touch on a lot of topics, you cover a lot of topics, and like you kind of campaign for a lot of you campaign for kind of underpaid workers, and you campaign for trans rights, LGBTQ rights, and also for marginalized communities as well. But the question I'm about to pose to you might be actually something that you face in your day-to-day job, but imagine you got the opportunity to sit down with one of your opponents. Let's say your opponent in question has invited you to sit down, like, all weapons down, no hard feelings. They've invited you for, say, like a sit down conversation, but this opponent in question is completely the opposite to you. So they are a traditionalist, they are a conservative, and not just conservative in terms of conservative party, but they are conservative in the small sense. They are the person that really is kind of out of touch on like queer rights and trans rights and so forth, like a really staunch person. It might be someone even within your constituency, and this is like a true political opponent. If you got the chance to sit down with them and have like a conversation with them, and they had the opportunity to conversate with you, so this of course is not like kind of like a sparring match where, you know, it kind of turns into a fight or so forth, but if you were to have like a genuine sit down, honest, no fights conversation with them about what it is that you do, what would be the kind of questions that you'd pose to them? Like, what would be the kind of things that you would ask, say, this political opponent of yours in the comfort of kind of not really fighting about it? That was just a question I wanted to pose to you, Nadia. What would you say?
I think I'd want to ask them what led to them feeling that way. And I'd want to speak to them about other people's experiences and how these aren't abstract conversations. These were about like real people's lives. And this is the impact that it has, and kind of make it about people's experiences and people's humanity. And I do believe that the vast majority of people are fundamentally good people.
Absolutely. And again, at the end of the day, it would be a beautiful situation. Obviously, it's a shame that the political discourse is divided the way it is, because obviously you do have people that are extremely, which are kind of not even just right of centre, that extremely right wing. And, you know, it's going to be hard to change those opinions. But as you say, there will be people who, if you just take them aside a bit, you'd have a sit down conversation, you will be able to kind of open their eyes up to just the other side of the political discourse as well. And you will probably get to show them that this is what the political discourse is like overall, even within my political sphere as well. And it would be a beautiful thing just to open their minds up, because they've probably not had that experience before, as you've mentioned. They've probably never had the opportunity to see it from the other side in a way. So as we wrap up this interview session here, I think what we have proved is that Nadia Whittam very much likes to go against the mainstream. Beautiful.
Oh, it's been great, guys. Thank you so much.
Also, we've proved that she's not a JLS fan, which, you know, it's fine. It's fine.
I mean, I don't dislike JLS. In fact, JLS is one of, like, my karaoke picks. But I'm just saying that I don't think they capture, like, the best of British pop music. Also, like, who can forget the JLS branded condoms? They were a moment.
And on that note, I think it's time to...
And we are done, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks very much for coming onto the podcast today. Nadia, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for coming on to Pop and Politics. Really appreciate your time.
Oh, it's been great being on. Thank you, both.
And that was the Labour MP for Nottingham East, Nadia Whittam, on Pop and Politics.